Right. Welcome to another great master class. Carlina, you want to go first?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. Let me see if I can share my screen.
All right.
Bear with me, everyone. I know I'm in tech, but this part always gets me. So give me one second. Okay. Can everyone see my screen?
Yes, we can.
Oh, wonderful. I actually did this right. Great. This is not what I wanted. So sorry. This is very embarrassing. I apologize, everyone. I am still adjusting to this, and I don't even know what happened to my slides. Give me... That's odd. There we go. That's not what I wanted.
Okay, don't are we starting the recording? No.
I started already.
Okay. I'm gonna put up the agenda. Yours was ADA compliant form. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So hi everyone. Today I'll be talking about how to make a ADA compliant form. Basically, just to give you a brief overview of this, what you'll be seeing in my presentation today is one, I create a form that will be ADA compliant, and I will also as well go over ADA compliance. So what is ADA compliance? It's the American Disability Act. It's a compliance are a specific guidelines for public organizations to follow to make devices such as computers and smart devices accessible to individuals with disabilities. So why is ADA compliance important for websites? Well, in short, you can be sued under U.S. law. Anyone can sue if a website is inaccessible. This can cost the website owner hundreds and thousands of dollars. And how to make your website ADA compliant? You can enable keyboard navigation. Many internet users are unable to navigate through a website via mouse, making them reliant on a keyboard and input devices. You can also include descriptions for images. This conveys information to the users, for example, that may be blind who need a description of what that image is. Test all forms on a website. Labels must be clearly defined and fields must be use visual cues. In addition, to make your website ADA compliant, you must avoid content that could trigger seizures or other physical reactions. Since some users may suffer from epilepsy and or other medical conditions, no element on a page should flash more than 3 times per second. Next, I have the tools that I actually typically use for when just testing for ADA compliance. So the tools I will typically use, even though there's others are out there, is WAVE, Web Accessibility, and Lighthouse. You can use this checking to see if your website's ADA compliant to go into further detail about what these tools are. So WAVE Web Accessibility is an evaluation tool that helps authors make their web content accessible with people with disabilities. WAVE can identify many web content accessibility guidelines, which is also known as WCAG errors. The screenshot that I actually took that's on your right-hand side, it was just a website that I found, and it's just showing what they look for: errors, contrast errors, alerts, features, structural elements, and ARIA. I will get into that shortly, the moment I actually show you how this tool is used on an actual website. Next, this is Lighthouse. This is used to improve the quality of web pages. It audits for performance accessibility, progressive web pages, search engine optimization, and so on. So what you see here are the scores that do come up when Lighthouse is used when it goes over testing a website. This small piece here that looks like an icon, this was the actual website that I actually used Lighthouse on to test its web accessibility. So next, now, how do we make your form ADA compliant? So the tag that you can typically use, and I'll also speak for myself, what I normally use is an ARIA label. So this defines a string value that labels an interactive element. You'll use the label tag, just defines the label of the element, and alt. Well, alt is typically used for images to convey what the image is. So now I would like to show you how web accessibility is used. What I will first like to go over with everyone is VoiceOver. So I actually created a form. So the form I was created was just go over an overview of what everything is. So as you see, I have an ARIA label use, things that you would normally use in your form when you want to make your website accessible. So when we run and debug it, so this is the form. Now, the main feature that I want you to see here, and I please everyone, if you could hear it, that would be wonderful. I'm just going to enable the voiceover so you can hear how web accessibility is actually utilized.
I don't hear anything. I don't know if you're tabbing through yet.
I'm so sorry. No one can hear anything?
Did you share with audio?
No, I'm actually playing it live, so you're not able to hear it.
You need to share. I thought you had to share with audio, even if you're
playing it live. So stop. Click the stop sharing. And then go to your share tray. And then before you click the screen, there's a toggle that says share with computer sound.
Oh, I see. Makes sense. Okay, I will do that right now. Once again, to everyone, I do apologize. So I will do this over, okay? So let me share. All right, so everyone should be able to see my screen again. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay, yes. Great. So I'm gonna run and debug it. And like you guys already did before, please feel free to interrupt if you do not hear anything, okay? Thank you.
Yeah, I don't hear it.
Yeah, we're not hearing anything.
Okay. Okay, I do apologize. You're still not hearing anything because I shared it with audio.
Right.
Okay. If you want, I can actually just move on and I can try to fix this later and we can just come back to me if that's okay with everyone.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. That's fine.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. So, next, just to go over web accessibility. I was showing what the passing grades will look like. So it'll have a level of either A, showing basic web accessibility, 2 A's, which is strong accessibility, and 3 means excellent accessibility. The website that I will actually be using the WAVE tool on specifically is just going to show you exactly what's being graded to the T. So give me 1 second. Actually, I think I can do this on any website. It doesn't even have to be that. So this was the website that I actually ended up using. So here I have the Google Chrome extension on how to use WAVE. When you click this, it actually marks where everything is, where to say suggestions really of what would need to be fixed. So just to get an overview of what everything is, you will go to details and actually explains to you what's missing. It will say here you're missing a form label, button, links. They can show you where your contrast errors are, and these are also just alerts. If you actually want to get more details of what each section explains, this little eye icon will actually tell you everything of what's missing, what's being looked for. As far as going over basically your how everything's ordered, structure showing all your headers, and then your contrast. What this goes into, if it actually pass, if this is actually web accessible. As you see, it gives you a score for this entire website as a pass. So that's what I have for now. So at this time, I guess just to let everyone know that I will be graduating, well, due for graduation February 21st, 2023. I still want to work on the voiceover slide. So I'll be working on that for the time being so everyone can hear what that is like. And that is my presentation for today. Thank you, everyone, for being here and listening.
Great job. Nice job. Is that something that you've done before, Carlina?
Oh, for ADA compliance, yes. Mm-hmm. I have actually worked on it before. I tested it out on a website before that I created. It's just unfortunate because I actually wanted you all to hear how voiceover works and the importance of why you should always put labels on your forms, using ARIA labels and everything. So what the whole voiceover was showing in that point, it was that anytime that a user, if they were just operating on their keyboard, if they went to a text box, I made it clear where it's like, enter your name, first and last name. And I'll also have instructions saying that this is a required field that they cannot leave it blank. And when, as far as radio buttons, I use a slider where basically, if someone was visually impaired, they will be able to understand exactly what they're doing on the form. So this is probably the most in-depth I got with it. So I did a lot more research, and I think this was a lot more rewarding than my last one because I got a much, much better understanding of how to use ADA compliance as well as ARIA labels.
Yep. That's neat. Yeah. Also, semantic HTML helps with screen readers.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Great job. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And who is up next? And I have trouble with your name every time. Is it?
I can do it.
This okay, Kenny. Kenny wants to jump in. Okay, Kenny. You're up.
Alrighty. So, Hold up one second. Is everybody seeing my screen?
Yes, we can.
All right, so tonight I'll be talking about Wireshark. I just recently learned about Wireshark, during my quest with the Purdue. So here's go. So as you can see, there's several things that you can do with Wireshark. There's package capturing, filtering, and visualization. As you can see on my slide, and then here's some more information. So for package capturing, they capture live package data from a network interface, and they save the package data captured, and then they also export all the package in a number of capture file format. Next thing they can do is the filter package on many criteria, so you can actually filter it by the on how the way how you want to filter. And then the third thing they can do is colorize package display back on the filter display back package with very detailed protocol information and create various statistic. Now the purpose of using Wireshark is to trouble some network like people who work on a network administrator can use to troubleshoot network problems. For security engineering, they can use examining security problems. QA engineering can use it to verify network application. Developer can use it to debug protocols, implementation, and we all can use it to learn network protocols internal. There's an advantage of using Wireshark. Wireshark is an open source software project that is released under the GNU, which is a general public license. You can freely use Wireshark on many numbers of computers you like without worrying about license keys or fee or such as. In addition, the source code is freely available under the GPL. And you can use it for either Windows or Unix, and also Linux too, which I will show you how to install on Windows and Linux later. Now, it says the advantage of using Wireshark. Wireshark is an intrusion detection system, so it will not warn you if someone like doing something strange on your network. It will not basically measure things like it's only measure things from it. It doesn't send package on a network. As you can see that on next slide. So the common use for Wireshark. So as you look at this picture, there's some in the picture showing that there's the IPCN, the IPv6 internet message control protocol traffic. And then you can also see that it drilled down to identify a network problem in there. So that's in the screenshot, which I can show you later too. There's some more information in regards to common use. Now, Wireshark is often used to identify more complex network issue. For example, if a network experiences too many retransmission, congestion can occur. By using Wireshark, you can identify specific retransmission issue as shown in the picture to the right. Now, for Windows, all you have to do is just go into this link, wireshark.org, and then you can just download. Depends on the version you have. If you have a 64-bit, then I would recommend you to download for the 64-bit. Now, for Linux, this is a step to download from Linux system. All you have to do is just run the sudo apt-get install Wireshark, and then it will do the rest for you. Now, the package capturing. Once you have installed the Wireshark, you can start grab the package network traffic. So once you open up Wireshark, it will give you the options to select which network you want to do the package capturing. As you can see on the right hand side, that is the option that you can select as the option. Here's some more information in regards to package capturing. This window lists all available interface. In this case, Wireshark provides several to choose from. And for this example, you select the Ethernet 3 interface, which will mostly have active interface. Wireshark visual the traffic by showing the moving line, which represent the package on the network. Once the network interface is selected, you simply click the start button to begin your capture. As the capture begins, it's possible to view the package that appears on the screen, which is shown in that figure. Once you capture all the package that you want, you can simply click the red square button at the top that's mean that you can stop the package from capturing. Now, there's some coloring rules in when you're using the Wireshark. If you look at the chart to the right, if you see a light purple, that's meaning that's a TCP. If you see a light blue, it's UDP. And if it's black, then this means that the package does an error with the package. Light green means there's an HTTP traffic. Yellow meaning that's Windows Pacific traffic, including server message block and net BIOS. Dark yellow mean routing, and then dark green mean a TCP sync, FIN, and ACK traffic. See, as you can see the figure, these are the color coded. Now, figure to the right show the default coloring rule. You can even change the default or apply a custom rule. If you don't want any coloring at all, you can go into View and then Colorize Packet List and just jungle so that if you want the color coloring back, simply click go back and click on the colorized package list again. It's possible even to colorize the specific conversation between computers. In this figure, you can see that the UDP, the standard UDP in a light blue, which is this right here, and the TCP is light yellow, light purple. TCP handshake is in dark gray, and then the routing traffic is in yellow, which I can show. I can run the Wireshark later to show you. And this is a 5-minute video on to run the Wireshark. So once you open the Wireshark application, you will see this screen right here. And once you I basically run this on a Wi-Fi. So once you select Wi-Fi, you can see that it's run. So double click on it and you should see it runs. So it's actually capturing the package right now. Which I will start the video here, and I'm actually going to pull up Wireshark so that way you guys can see. So when you pull up Wireshark, you will see the screen right here. And then what I do is I just double click on the Wi-Fi. Since I'm running Wi-Fi right now, I double click on it. It will show you all the information. So let's say, for example, the light blue is it was show as, let's see, one second, standard UDP. So if you notice, it's actually, if you go under the protocol, it will show that the light blue is UDP. So right now it's running right now, and I'm capturing the package right now. And if you notice, as at the bottom, it said live capture in progress. And that's all I have for my presentation.
Very nice, Kenny. I enjoy Wireshark.
It's actually fun.
It is. It truly is. Have you just been started using it, or is it something you've used in the past?
I was using during my class on the class side. I was like training through it. I went through some training with it, and then I realized that I enjoy with it. So that's the reason why I did a presentation on it.
Hey, awesome. Good job. Good job.
Thanks.
All right. Like I said, I don't want to mess up your name. It's Bart.
Yes, Bart, like the Simpsons.
Okay, all right, I'll call you Bart. Yep. You ready to go?
Yep.
All right.
You guys can see my screen?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. All right, so today I'll be presenting to you guys the Wi-Fi Pineapple Mark 7. Okay, so here's a general overview of how the Wi-Fi Pineapple looks like. On your left side, you have the Mark 7 Basic. Then you have in the middle the Wi-Fi adapter. And on the right is them together. Size-wise, they're probably as big as your hand. I don't know, I'd say like 8 inches, 9 inches maybe. From the left, this will cost you around $120 just for the basic. The adapter is $80. Together, they have a package on hack5.com. For $200, you also get a carrying tote, which is pretty cute as well. Some general features. The Wi-Fi Pineapple from Hack5 is a versatile tool that can be used to perform network security audits. It is a small, portable device that has the ability to create an access point and act as an attack platform. It includes advanced features such as multiple SSIDs, rogue DNS servers, evil twin access points. The Wi-Fi Pineapple can also be used to perform man-in-the-middle attacks, denial-of-service attacks, and social engineering attacks. Just a few little specs here. Without the adapter, you do only get 2.4 gigahertz. Something that's pretty interesting about this is these are really high gain antennas. So people have been reporting they'll get up to the 20th story, let's say in like a downtown, for example, Chicago area, you'll get up to the 20th story of Wi-Fi access, which is pretty interesting. There is three ways you could actually connect to this. One is through USB-C. The second one is SSH, and the third one is by connecting it through a web browser. So this is the adapter itself. It is mainly used for 5 gigahertz channels. And it's not really that necessary to have, but if you could buy it, I guess it's worth having. Okay, so now let's do the login. So here's the login screen after you set up the Wi-Fi Pineapple, which takes around, out of the box, I don't know, maybe like 15 minutes. It's really easy to set up. They give you a really, really nice guide that I could show you in a second. Let me just sign in. Okay, so I've been using this already, so it won't come out of the box looking like this. So they obviously give you a nice guide to go through. Very informative. It goes through a bunch of things, even helps you understand what Wi-Fi is and a bunch of other stuff like that. So let's start on the GUI. Okay, so we have a notifications tab here, which I already have some things popping up. The notifications tab will have things like info, warning, error, successes, or unknown things that enter your Pineapple. Also will give you informational messages such as misconfigurations, and it will tell you potential ways to fix them. Then we have the web terminal. Open up here. It is a bash shell on the Wi-Fi Pineapple without needing to use SSH. You can use it to manage the device, run tools, install packages, and do pretty much anything else you can do on a Linux computer. It's pretty basic. On the rightmost, the three dots gives you more of a help. And settings, you could check your internet connection. There's also three ways you can connect to the internet. The wireless mode, connection sharing through USB-C, and then adapter from an RJ45 Ethernet adapter as well. So let's go back to the main dashboard. This is the landing page, and it provides glance insights to the system and its services. So you have the system status, disk usage. Right now, it's only 2% since I don't really have anything running. I've made campaigns already, so I already have a few clients that I had connected before. SSIDs, Wi-Fi SSIDs. No current connected clients. Oh, I shouldn't have any. Notifications and campaigns. So let's move on to campaigns. Campaigns are pretty interesting. They let you do a lot of things. Let me see where my right spot. Okay, here. And then we have our PineAP suite. There's a few modes in the PineAP, which is a passive. It identifies client devices susceptible to basic rogue access points or evil twin attacks. It mimics access points only upon direct request, and depending on filter configuration, client devices may be allowed to associate with the Wi-Fi pineapple. Then you have the active, which really only is a significant difference of SSID pool broadcasting. And then advanced mode, where you can impersonate all the networks that you see around you. There's also, you can log the advanced client connect notifications, disconnect notifications. You could advertise back all of the SSIDs that you see around you. So let's say your neighbor's SSID is Mark Wi-Fi. You could capture that Wi-Fi and advertise it back out to make people think that you are his Wi-Fi, and they'll connect to you. You could also capture handshakes, as you can see on the top. And you could reconfigure some specific filters that you'd like. So let's move on to the OpenAP. This is the access point that you will create for most people, or for everyone that you want to be connecting to your access point from the pineapple. It more than likely will not have a password. It will just be the name. And you could pick a few channels for them to connect through, depending on how populated of SSIDs your area is and how strong you want the connection to be. Then we have the evil WPA, which we won't get into either. It's a little bit complicated to explain, as well as the enterprise version. It's very hard to set up, as you must have a specific kind of account, and it does take a lot of disk usage and CPU and memory. So last thing I could show you is the impersonation. So I'm gonna refresh this. Oh, I guess not. Okay, so clients, filtering. What else I could show you? Oh, so filtering, you could have a deny list, allow list for the what type of people you want to connect to your AP. You might want this if you know that someone has already connected and they look suspicious, or if they look like some, I don't know, government agency. This stuff isn't really the most ethical if you're going to do it in malpractice, but if you're going to be testing networks, you should more than likely be fine. Let's go to Recon. In the Recon tab, we can run a scan. Run a quick scan of 30 seconds. Soon we'll be populating some SSIDs in the area. Oh, there you go. As you can see, we have the SSID, the MAC address, the OUI, which is the producer, the clients that are connected to them, which I don't really find to be true, the type of security that they're using, MFP. So MFP is actually quite important. It actually provides security between handshakes. So when we do handshakes later, you won't be able to capture handshakes from people that have MFP on, because it'll provides a certain type of encryption during the handshake process. So if you are at home and you do have a upgraded router, not something simple that you get from Comcast, AT&T, or whatever your ISP is, I'd recommend to have MFP turned on so people can't capture your handshakes. What else? WPS, not really that important here. You can see the type of signal that we have. And I don't really live in a heavily populated area, but as of 30 seconds, I did generate 44 SSIDs, which is a quite significant amount compared to when you're trying to connect to Wi-Fi on your phone, you only get 10 or 15. Another thing that we can do is, which is interesting, we can deauthenticate clients on a certain SSID, which I won't do because it's very mean to my neighbors, but also really interesting. So something else that we can do here is collect handshakes where I already have here opened from a few seconds ago. I've been capturing handshakes for a few days. I just leave my AP on. It automatically captures handshakes from other SSIDs in the area or Wi-Fi access points in the area. You can then use it gives you the type of PCAP or a hashcat file that you could then download onto your computer. You can use hashcat or airmonng to crack the passwords. Passwords cracking may take between a couple minutes to a couple hours, depending on how much of a quality of a password that the user or the AP is using. Then we could go on to, so this is just logging everything that I do on the system. It's nice to know so that if you did mess up something earlier, you can see where you went wrong. We also have modules and packages that you could install onto your Wi-Fi panel. There's two that I have installed, but I want to show you some other ones. So you have MAC info, locate, cabinet, MDK4, nmap, TCP dump, and MTR. So these are ones that are mostly used by most people that do buy these Wi-Fi pineapples. You could also get other packages from like GitHub. They automatically give you a nice GUI here. You can automatically download. But a few that I have downloaded is the Evil Portal and the HTTP. So first, I'd like to show you the HTTP. I'll connect the pineapple on my second computer. I'm connected. I'm one of the clients. Let's enable HTTP. I will go to a website called CERN, which is actually one of the first ever websites made. I just want to generate some traffic so that you guys could see. So this is some stuff that I just browsed on my second computer. The only disappointing part about this is not a lot of websites use only HTTP. Most do really use HTTPS. And so getting a lot of data from this isn't so useful. So now let's go to Evil Portal. So the Evil Captive Portal is a portal when you, or just like when you enter a hotel or restaurant like McDonald's and you have to agree to the terms and service. Usually they tell you to put in your email or something of what room that you're using just so they get some data when you are connected. So a few portals that are really interesting that I really like is, let's say, the Starbucks one. So I'm gonna activate it. So this is whenever someone connects that's new. So we could preview it here. So this is what it looks like when they go on their phone or on their laptop and they type in the SSID and they want to connect to it to get internet. They'll get something like this. So I'm actually going to connect on my phone with the Wi-Fi. And I'll type something in here so that you guys will see what it looks like for the user. Okay, so I've connected to my phone, and let's see if we get a log file. Oh, we do. And so I've connected. I use the email, which is actually my personal email. I wrote the password, which is not so secret anymore, wrong, but it still captures things, which is really nice in the evil way. That's why it's called the Evil Portal. That's pretty much all for this presentation. Thank you so much. Any questions, feel free to ask.
Nice job.
Thank you.
Kind of scary, though.
Yeah, it does give you some interesting options.
Absolutely.
To play around with.
Does anybody have any questions for the presenters? That was all we had, right? The three?
Oh, no.
Oh.
I think we have seven, actually.
Yeah, so nobody else spoke up at the beginning. Who else is presenting?
Me.
Oh, okay.
Michael. Yeah. I was just kind of, because it looked like that there were a lot on the notification.
Yes. On the sheet, like right? Full, yeah. Right, Marjorie?
Yeah, we have Michael after this, and then we have, I'm looking through here, Braden. And then Isaac,
okay.
And then Pax. So okay. They're all listed in the chat. Okay, yeah. So Michael, you are next.
All right. So my presentation's on governance, risk, and compliance. It's not the most exciting subject. It has some tech in it a little bit, but you know. And so basically I pre-recorded, not as a video, but I did pre-record the audio because I was trying to keep my time and I wanted to make sure I didn't go over, and because I can get long-winded a little bit, so we don't want to do that. But I'm still controlling the slides one by one, and so if anything happens, I can, you know, answer questions or stop. So, all right, let's get this going. And if you can't hear me, I did rehearse this a little bit, and so if you can't hear me, just let me know. Okay. Can everybody see the screen?
Yes.
All right. All right. So we'll get this going. Welcome to my presentation covering governance, risk, and compliance, or GRC, the other side of cybersecurity. After this presentation, you will know what GRC is, what the role of a GRC analyst consists of, and a few more details about that career. I have quite a few slides, so let's get going. Everybody heard that, right?
Yep, we can hear it.
I just wanted to be sure. That's why I did the first slide a little bit. So what is GRC? GRC is a strategy to manage an organization's governance and compliance with regulations. But let's break it down a little further. While we're here, also take a look at figure one. The term GRC first started making its appearance in early 2000. When corporate financial scandals such as Enron and WorldCom were taking place, laws like Sarbanes and Oxley were put into place to help prevent these acts in the future. There are always a lot of audits and controls required for compliance with these laws, so groups that perform GRC are usually quite busy. The idea of governance is easy. It is ensuring that information technology operations are not just managed, but also remain in alignment with the goals of the organization. The term risk refers to the use of risk management processes to identify risks and address those risks in a manner that does not compromise the goals of the organization. It is far too easy for one to identify risks and just say, turn it off. What if the organization needs the software or hardware? Managing the risk should be done by proposing a solution that can mitigate the risk without sacrificing business continuity. Don't use it is not always an option. Compliance. Maintaining compliance never ends. Existing regulations change and new ones are created as often as needed. Ensuring that organizational activities are conducted in ways that are legal and meet existing regulations is one of the primary functions of the GRC team. Now that you know a little about GRC, let's discuss the connection between GRC and cybersecurity. Outside of the workplace, every time I've been in a conversation about cybersecurity, it's always about the IT side of things. Can you configure this? How well is the firewall doing? Is the proxy blocking that social media website? While these are things that protect systems and networks, ask yourself, why are they configuring things that way? This question is why I created this presentation. Why are we configuring the firewall, proxy server, DLP network device, and other credential policies the way we do? What drives these decisions? There was once a time when a network administrator may have made this decision based on some Beth Snow methods or experience. However, that is not the case anymore. In my organization, GRC and cybersecurity are integrated, and the side that pushes all the buttons is system monitoring and incident response, or SMEAR. GRC is the other side of cybersecurity, and we support cybersecurity by standardizing best practices, implementing new policies and procedures, supporting auditing and control monitoring, and ensuring that all government and industry standards and regulations are met. Today, it is all about compliance, and that is all about GRC. The whole existence of GRC is a great concept. While cybersecurity, or in my case, the SMEAR group, is configuring networks and servers, GRC is free to make sure all those things are done securely and meet regulations. GRC provides cybersecurity with many technical benefits. For example, when selecting system, network, and software vendors, GRC is tasked with providing vendor assessment to ensure that only reputable candidates are used. Through the use of assessments, GRC can also document the current strengths and weaknesses of existing security controls and suggest what changes are needed for improvement. GRC supports compliance by creating, managing, and maintaining any organizational policies that are required to meet or maintain regulatory compliance. Information security audits are tedious, come often, and require a lot of manpower to get done. That's where GRC comes in. GRC supports these audits by ensuring that all policies, methods of operation, and other required documents exist and are up to date and available. It is the responsibility of GRC to ensure that the appropriate protection, logging, storage, etc., are in place to defend all data collected, stored, and processed by the organization. Also, being part of the security audits, system assessments, and other cybersecurity related events allows GRC to provide management and personnel with the security related visibility needed to make good decisions for the organization. The tasks of a GRC cybersecurity analyst on any given day would be insurmountable without a team of quality coworkers to support them. This all sounds pretty busy, but what is all this work? While not every GRC analyst does every task, it takes them all to get the job done. A big part of the job is doing assessments, whether it be approving a new vendor that needs system access or doing an assessment of every single server, computer, and application used by the organization before it can be installed on the organization's network. Assessments take a lot of time and also have to be renewed biannually or even more often if a risk is present. Not all business areas know the rules and regulations surrounding cybersecurity, so GRC works with those units to evaluate whether security risks exist and offers acceptable security controls for identified risks. Once the controls are implemented, GRC is also responsible for ensuring that these controls are used. Maintaining compliance often requires security awareness training. As a team, GRC plans, creates, and executes security awareness programs, including periodic user education and anti-phishing campaigns. Maintaining documentation is my favorite task. I'm currently in charge of maintaining the documents that contain the security standards, procedures, processes, and guidelines for my organization. GRC also compiles weekly, monthly, and annual performance metrics for upper management to show cybersecurity effectiveness. This last one is what everyone right out of college wants, and that is to keep up to date on different regulatory compliance standards. This is pretty much continual regulatory training and obtaining those wonderful certifications specific to your job role in cybersecurity. What is authorization to operate? The term authorization to operate, or ATO, refers to permission for a product to be used in an existing system. ATOs are commonly used in government information technology. However, the same concept is used by many private organizations. Both new and revised software applications require ATOs before they are allowed to connect to and function on an organization's network. My current organization requires that ATOs be issued for every server and application on the network. Whether it is off the shelf or developed in-house, they don't access the network without an ATO. ATOs keep me very busy. ATOs are needed for various reasons. In my organization, a few different situations can start the ATO process. The most common reasons for needing ATOs are new software development or purchase, updated or modified software, renewing an existing ATO. The ATO process can be very tedious. It consumes time, and the typical ATOs that I work on require renewal every few years, depending on the vulnerabilities found. I would estimate that a quarter of our cybersecurity workload is ATO related. Additionally, malicious actors are always looking for new vulnerabilities, so requiring ATOs to be renewed at least biannually is essential to keep things secure. Following the official NIST risk management framework, there are a lot of things that go into an ATO, but many of these things are accomplished during product development or acquisition before the ATO is officially requested. Once the system has been categorized based on its importance to the organization, security controls are selected and implemented based on the system's importance. When security controls are in place, the assessment, authorization, and monitoring processes can occur. For me, the assessment stage is where my job usually begins. That is when the ATO is typically formally requested. Now that we know the official NIST ATO steps, let's take a look at the workflow I follow when doing an ATO. Immediately following the ATO request, a vulnerability assessment questionnaire is sent to the requester. The assessment questionnaire usually contains all the information needed for me to continue the ATO process. Depending on the type of system, a vulnerability scan or penetration test is scheduled. If the system is externally facing or an internet application, a third-party penetration test is always required. If the application is internal and deals with tax information or personal information, a third-party penetration test is also required. All other systems and applications can usually be assessed with an internally originated vulnerability scan or a less invasive and costly internal penetration test. What would an ATO be without a vulnerability scan? Well, it would be too easy. Let's take a look at a real vulnerability scan that I performed on February 8th of this year. While I could not perform this scan on one of my organization's systems, I pulled out an old system from my closet. The system was originally an externally facing web server based on Windows Server 2003. I used it as my test system because I was sure it would be a vulnerability cesspool. I scanned the system using the Nessus Essentials application, and the scan took approximately 24 minutes. And guess what? I was right. The system is so vulnerable, it should not have even been turned on. Figure 3 is the actual computer that is running the operating system, and the laptop is my personal one that I performed the scan with. Of course, the scan was conducted within my home network, but I showed a direct connection for easy visuals. Look at the vulnerability scan results summary in Figure 4. You can see that Nessus found 5 critical vulnerabilities and 4 medium ones. My organization also considers the low-risk vulnerabilities, but they do not usually affect the approval of the ATO. On this slide, Figure 5 just shows a bit more detail about the vulnerabilities that Nessus found. Going a bit further, you can see in Figure 6 that the critical vulnerability is due to WebDAV being enabled on the system. This vulnerability could result in an unauthenticated attacker causing a denial of service condition. Normally, there would be a solution or workaround for most critical findings, but in this case, Windows Server 2003 and Internet Information Services 6.0 are no longer maintained. So the system in my closet is effectively trash. However, for this ATO process, we are going to assume it can be fixed. Once the scan results are received, they are evaluated to determine a low, medium, or high risk. The findings are submitted to the ATO requester, and the remediation plan is agreed on. If the remediation plan is accepted, the completed ATO form is submitted to all involved parties for approval. In my organization, if critical vulnerabilities are found that cannot be fixed, the ATO can still be approved, but it has to go to the highest level, a CEO or executive director, etc. This does not happen very often, since the lower employees do not want to lose their jobs if the vulnerability is exploited. Now that we know a little about GRC and ATOs, let's look at a growing trend, separating IT from cybersecurity. Why should IT and cybersecurity be separated? Personally, I believe that integrating IT and cybersecurity is no longer an effective method to do either. It is easy to think that since IT deals with where data is stored and what type of data is being stored, that IT is the best choice for security too. It is also not uncommon to see the merge of these two teams or jobs into one. However, there are good reasons why this should no longer be the case. Separation helps to optimize each department. Cybersecurity can focus on all aspects of information security, leaving IT more focused on its tasks. Accessibility interferes less with security and compliance, since cybersecurity can measure a company's entire level of risk and implement measures to protect the company without IT projects or schedules getting in the way. If they were together, the priorities of IT may negatively impact those of information security, resulting in reduced security measures being in place. Despite their similarities, cybersecurity and information technology are not the same things. These differences create quite a few reasons why they are better separated. Auditing is my big concern on the issue. IT will take a blind eye to a security issue if it impacts a project schedule too much. This may seem counterproductive, but it happens every day. The fox guarding the hen house is not a good idea. And from my experience, many auditors and regulations frown on this practice. Also, the bigger the budget, the more resources are available. And this holds true in this situation. With separate budgets, cybersecurity funding will not suffer due to IT and cybersecurity priorities not being well aligned. Also, separating finances usually means bigger employee budgets, allowing each group to expand and hire more well-qualified people. Don't forget, there are tons of cybersecurity GRC positions out there. If you can't find them, then just add GRC to whatever cybersecurity job search you are doing. Also, search for Cybersecurity Analyst 1 positions and stick GRC on there. These may not all be entry level, but you can do it. I would like to thank everyone for viewing my masterclass presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Nice job, Michael.
Yeah, it was fun.
I like your picture.
Yeah, there's a big story behind that. We won't even go there.
All right.
Let me kill this.
Great job. All right. I'm learning so much tonight. I learned so much on Thursday nights. Brayden, you ready?
Hey, I'm ready. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right. Let me get this going. All right. Can you see my screen there?
Sure can.
Okay. So this is, I'm going to cover like a basic guide to building your own computer and kind of why you would want to do this, the pros and cons of doing this. And I want to emphasize the word basic here, because if I were to go into full detail about all this stuff, this thing would be like hours long. So it's kind of just for people who've never done this before. You know, if you built your own PC or you know a bit about PC hardware, there may be nothing new in here for you. But anyways, let's get started. All right. So the reasons why you would want to do your own PC build is because it allows you to get the most amount of performance for the lowest cost, and you can kind of prioritize performance based on what you need. So, if you're someone that does a lot of multitasking, you know, you can upgrade certain parts, and it's always easy to upgrade later. You know, you can start with a more basic system that doesn't cost as much. And, you know, if you find yourself needing any kind of, you know, extra storage, memory, processing power, you just need to buy that part and install it in your system. Some of the cons of building your own PC is there are certain aspects of assembling everything that can be kind of difficult, and it's really only on you if something goes wrong, you break a part while you're trying to install it. But you know, there's no warranty for the whole entire computer, but in a lot of cases, the warranties for the individual parts are going to be a little bit better than if you buy a pre-built system. They cover more things and last a little bit longer. So, you know, pros and cons there. So you kind of want to think about what you use your computer for, the type of programs you run and the type of tasks you do when you're thinking about the parts you're going to choose, which arguably is the hardest part of building a computer, is just picking which parts you're going to buy, because there's millions of parts and they're only compatible with certain other parts, and you know, I could go on. So that little bullet there, pcpartpicker.com, if this is something you're interested in doing, I would really recommend using that website. It allows you to go through and kind of assemble your computer, and it'll automatically check for compatibility. You know, you need a power supply to power your computer. And once you pick out all of your parts, PC Part Picker will tell you the estimated power output of your computer, so you can buy the exact power supply that you need. It's just a really great tool to kind of help you in your building process. All right. So you should start by picking which processing units and processing unit or CPU that you're going to use. And AMD and Intel are really the two that you're going to be choosing from. So the most recent generation of CPUs came out sometime last year. And it kind of makes more sense now, based on my research, if you're going to go with a newer generation chip, to go Intel. But in, I don't know, 4 or 5 years before that, AMD kind of held the top spot for just general price for performance and workstation use. So I'm just going to kind of, what I'm going to do is compare the newest generation Intel chips with the last generation AMD chips, because it kind of makes for the most useful cost comparison, in my opinion. One of the things you want to look at is your clock speed, or gigahertz is kind of going to be the speed of the processor. The amount of cores is important. But, you know, I mean, if you're just using your computer for word processing, internet use and things like that, it really is not going to make that much of a difference. I mean, you know, do your own research about the chips that you're going to get. But for general use, there's not really that big of a difference. So we'll start with AMD. And the reason why I said the last generation chips might be a little bit better to look at is because the current generation chips that just came out are only compatible with the AM5 socket motherboards, which are more expensive, and the new DDR5 memory, which is faster and it's going to perform better, but it's pretty costly right now because it's so new. So the 5000 series Ryzen chips are what I would recommend if you're going to go AMD, because you can use an AM4 socket motherboard, which is quite a bit less expensive. They've been around forever, and you can find pretty good deals on them. And those will also let you use DDR4 memory, which also has been around for a while and is quite a bit cheaper. So I have two chip recommendations here. The Ryzen 5 5600G is a 6-core processor, and pretty much all AMD chips come with a pretty good CPU cooler. Like, unless you're going to be doing like overclocking or something, those stock CPU coolers are really all you're going to need, and it's included. So you'll see there's the G at the end of the 5600 there means that it has an iGPU, or integrated graphics, meaning that you won't need a dedicated graphics card if you have one of these. And that can save you a lot of money, because GPUs are usually the GPU and the CPU are the two most expensive parts of your system. So that chip there, 6 cores. I mean, if you're coming from a laptop, the performance of this thing's going to be really great. And it's only $139. The other one I recommended is the Ryzen 7 5700. Also has integrated graphics, so you won't need a graphics card. And you get an 8-core CPU for $199. So a little bit more. And, you know, if you right now, 6 cores is really great. I mean, perhaps in a couple of years, you know, if when programs get more expensive, more intensive, you may need a little bit more. So, you know, if you have the extra money to spend and want to look forward a little bit, maybe look into the 8 core option. But so for Intel, so kind of back to AMD, traditionally have been better workstation chips, but Intel has always edged them out a little bit, not always, but over that past 4 to 5 year period I was talking about, when it comes to gaming, like frame rates and things, towards the higher end of the chips and, you know, running intensive programs like gaming or 3D modeling, photo and video editing while, you know, having 10 Chrome tabs open or whatever you want to do. Usually the cooler that comes with Intel isn't quite as high performing as AMD, but again, if you're just doing, you know, basic stuff, it's going to be fine. So for Intel, the reason why I'm recommending the newest generation of Intel chips is because, I mean, the newest manufacturing processor that are used on manufacturing processes that are used on the Intel CPUs is going to kind of give it a inherent little bit of an edge. You don't need to use DDR5 with the newest gen Intel CPUs. And so these are two options that are similarly priced to the AMD ones that I just discussed. The Core i3 is a 4-core CPU, so a little bit less than the AMD option, but that doesn't always mean that it's not going to perform as well. Plus, it's a newer generation. So, you know, do some research on benchmarks and different programs and kind of, you know, see what's best for you. Next one, the Core i5 is a 6-core, also integrated graphics on both of these. So if you want to, you can save by not using a graphics card. Now, from what I've seen, the ones that don't have integrated graphics really aren't that much cheaper. So, you know, it kind of just makes sense to go with an integrated GPU. I mean, there's a little bit of performance upgrade without having the iGPU, but again, this is kind of a basic guide, so we'll just leave it at that. Now, the motherboard that you choose is that's where you're going to connect all of the components that you're purchasing for the computer, your CPU, GPU, RAM, your hard drives are going to be plugged into that, your case. So this is a pretty important part, but like I said here at the second bullet point, there's kind of a sweet spot that, you know, you want to get a quality board, but the ones that are like super expensive and have all this extra stuff and tons of, you know, heat sinks and everything aren't always really going to provide that much of a benefit for how much more you're going to be paying for them. So kind of look at what's available. And I think mine was like $130, $140 or so. So something kind of around there is going to be perfect. So for the AMD options I listed, you'll want to look for motherboards that have an AM4 socket. For the Intel, it's the new generation has the LGA 1700 socket. So in my computer and kind of what I recommend, I would say look for something with integrated Wi-Fi. They're not that much more expensive. And when I was kind of building out my computer, buying one without integrated Wi-Fi means you need a network adapter if you're going to be needing Wi-Fi and you don't have access to a direct connection. It's more expensive than just buying a board that already has it. Plus, it's easier. And a cool thing with the integrated Wi-Fi on a lot of these boards, you also get that includes Bluetooth. So like, if you have Bluetooth headphones or any other Bluetooth devices, you can kind of just connect them right to the computer. It's pretty nice. So I'm going to recommend the ATX mid tower size. It's kind of in the middle. They're the easiest to build. They have the most amount of parts available. and usually are a little bit less expensive. You know, some of the full towers can be huge, and the small ATX form factors are pretty hard to work in, and you have to do a lot of research to make sure that the parts you buy are going to fit properly. So it's kind of, in my opinion, a good place to start if this is your first PC build. You know, of course, it's nice to have a smaller system. You can, it doesn't take up as much room, but the mid tower cases are not that big. It's just slightly bigger than a normal like HP pre-built system you would buy. So here I have a, this is the different sizes of motherboards that you can get. I'm going to say, so for the mid tower cases, usually they'll have mounting points for either the micro ATX or the ATX. ATX, I mean, there's really not a huge price difference between them, and ATX is going to offer you a little bit more functionality and more ports, more places to plug things in. So that kind of is what makes sense to me. There's bigger ones and smaller ones, but these are kind of the main ones. So as far as the cases that I was just talking about, this is kind of a general sizing guide for the most common one. Like with the motherboards, there's a lot more sizes than this, but this is just the most common ones. And that mid tower there in the middle is the one that I'm going to be recommending, just because, you know, it's, you have enough, and you're going to have enough space to use pretty much any parts you want. You're not going to worry about space. There are, in some cases, you can even get, you can fit the regular ATX size motherboard in many towers if you need to keep space down. But again, it's just going to require you to do a little bit more research to make sure that everything is going to fit. So, you know, pick out those two parts. And some things to consider, you know, do research on all the parts you're buying. Like I was saying, this is probably the most difficult part of building a computer, is picking the parts and knowing what you need. But look at the amount of USB connections it has on the rear and on the front I/O, and you know, if you need USB-C, or some come with like SD card readers and things like that. You know, there should be plenty of information when you're looking at these online. If you're trying to keep costs down, this is a pretty good place to do it, because, you know, cases are kind of just there to hold everything and to cool them down. So there's not a ton of places where you can have like catastrophic failure in a case. Corsair has tons of options, cheap ones, expensive ones, and they are generally pretty good about airflow. But there's tons of companies, and you know, you can have some fun with this. Some of them are pretty cool looking. You know, go look at them, and you know, if you want to pick one with a nice style or color or whatever, you can. A lot of cases you're going to find will come with pre-installed fans, which is nice. If they don't, you'll need to purchase fans separately. And typically that's going to be a 120 millimeter fan you're going to use. Some use 80, but most of the new ones are 120 millimeter. So here's a couple pictures of kind of, you know, if your case comes with pre-installed fans, it's going to kind of already be set up like this. But just in case they don't, if you're going to be installing your own fans, I have this little diagram here on the left showing the direction of airflow for the fans. Usually the air comes out towards where the label is, but any fan you buy is probably going to provide you with a similar diagram so you can see kind of exactly what you're getting. But that picture on the right is kind of how you want to have it set up. I mean, it can be flipped. It's really you just want to have an equal amount of fans pulling air in as you do pushing air out. So you have, you know, air consistently flowing through the system, because the parts can get pretty hot, especially if you're doing intensive tasks like photo video editing, 3D modeling, gaming, things like that. All right, so RAM is a pretty important part of the system. So I have some options listed here. And the thing is, RAM's super easy to upgrade. So you can, you know, if you're really trying to keep the cost down, you can go with just a 4 gigabyte single single channel is probably what 4 gigabyte will be. But I mean, this is all of the options I provided for CPUs are compatible with DDR4 RAM, which is pretty inexpensive. Like, you can get 16 gigabytes for $50 or sometimes less. And, you know, unless you're doing multiple like intensive programs and having 20 Chrome tabs open all the time, that's really all that you're going to need. So that's pretty much it for memory. Storage. So, you know, your drives, what kind of drives you're going to use, makes a difference in performance. And obviously, if you have, you know, if your use case needs, you know, tons of storage, there's a few different ways to do that. So, I can't recommend enough. I did this with my system and its performance has been awesome. Using an NVMe M.2 SSD drive. So you have to make sure you get a motherboard that has compatibility for these, but they transfer files and load programs like blazing fast. And, what you can do is just buy, you know, I think 256 gigabytes is, I think, is the smallest size you can buy. Maybe you can go lower than that, but those aren't that expensive. And, you know, all you need to do is put your Windows installation and, like, you know, if there's some programs you use all the time, you know, maybe put those programs on there. And then when it comes to like storing stuff that you don't really use too often, you can put it on some slower storage. Like, I mean, SATA SSD, if you want to kind of do a similar thing with, you know, having a SATA SSD like boot drive, those are still no slouch. Those are going to be pretty fast. And again, coming from like a laptop or a pre-built system, you're probably going to be pretty happy with the performance of one of those. And then the old HDD or hard disks are the one that have the spinning disks. You know, great for if you're going to, you know, storing large amounts of data, because you can get terabytes of that stuff for really not that much money. All right. And so you'll need to power everything that you've bought. And again, I mean, really the best way to do this is go to PC Part Picker and put in everything you have, and it'll automatically calculate what kind of wattage you're going to need out of your power supply. But this is a part, you know, if you're trying to save as much money as you can, I would recommend doing that in other places, because, you know, power supply failures and faulty power supplies can cause issues with other components of your system. And it's just, you know, this is what's providing power to everything. And it's, you know, the most can kind of go wrong with one of these. Not that they usually do. I mean, typically they're pretty reliable, but yeah, that's for the power supply. And so you don't necessarily need a graphics card for the options that I have outlined, because your CPUs would have integrated graphics. Some reasons why you would want to is if you do like video and photo editing, things will run a lot faster, and 3D modeling, like Blender, CAD, you can, you know, have a lot higher poly stuff in your viewport, and rendering is going to be a lot faster. And then gaming, if you like to play games, you know, if the graphic quality of the game or frame rates are important, then, you know, maybe consider getting a GPU. If the GPU market's kind of calmed down a little bit, now that cryptocurrency isn't as crazy as it used to be. So, you can get them for a pretty reasonable price. Like, I do some gaming on mine, and I came from an Xbox One to like a really cheap graphics card, and I was like blown away by the performance. You don't need to go crazy with these to see a real increase in graphics performance. All right. So you can sometimes it makes sense, you know, again, if you're trying to keep the cost down as much as you can, there are some places where it's okay to buy used parts. Some are safer than others. So one, RAM. Most of the time it's going to be okay to purchase secondhand, but, you know, right now the RAM is so cheap anyway. There may be better places to do it. The thing is, so CPUs sometimes can be a bit fragile if you don't handle them properly, but they're actually like the performance themselves, they're pretty reliable. And they can, that you can save a good amount of money there. But you know, if you're going to go eBay, make sure it's like a, you know, a seller with a really good rating and all that stuff. I have a CPU in one of my computers from eBay, some RAM from eBay, my GPUs from eBay, and none of those parts have had any problems. But, you know, with used stuff, you never really know. Cases are another good one. There's not too much that can go wrong with those, so you can buy those used if you find a good deal. Then, of course, your peripherals, mouses, keyboards, speakers, monitors, pretty much always going to be fine. Riskiest of those is monitors, like I've said there. If possible, look into local sales so you can test the product out before you buy it, make sure it doesn't have any dead pixels or anything. All right, so we're kind of getting into assembling the computer. And so you'll want, you don't really need something like this, but I bought, I think, this exact kit on Amazon for like $20, and I've just used it for so many more things than I ever thought that I would. It's just having all those little random bits comes in handy a lot with just any kind of electronics. So, you know, good to have something like this. It's super cheap. It'll make installation a little bit easier. And then some zip ties, cable ties, you know, you want to keep your wires organized and tidy. All right, so we'll start with assembly of installing the CPU. So in my opinion, the best way to do it is to put everything you can onto your motherboard first before putting the motherboard in the system. Make sure you don't set it on anything that's going to damage the back of it. A really good way to do it is use the box that your motherboard came in. It'll already be pretty much the perfect size. Just set the motherboard on top of that and install everything onto it. And putting your CPU in is probably, I say difficult here, it may be the not difficult but riskiest, because it's an expensive component, and like I said before, they're a bit fragile. So up here, the top right is the AM4 socket. And with these, the CPU itself is going to fit right on top of there, and the CPU has pins that stick down into all those little holes you see. The proper way to align it, it varies a little bit, but if you can see in the bottom left corner of that socket, there's like that little triangle, and that will usually correspond with another triangle on your chip. So you can't just insert it anyway. It needs to be going in a certain way. And another thing is, if you see that little metal bar on the right, that needs to be up before you put the computer in, or before you put the CPU chip in. So pull that up, make sure it's aligned properly, put it in, and then push that thing back down, and the CPU should be pretty much locked in place. And then down here is the LGA 1700 socket. That's going to be for the Intel chips. And those work in kind of the opposite way. So the pins stick up out of the socket, and the CPU itself is just going to have those contact points. And part of the reason why this is so fragile is you can see there's hundreds, if not thousands, of them. So, you know, if one of those gets bent, you know, with the AM4 socket, your CPU is screwed. With the Intel socket, your motherboard is screwed. So you just want to make sure you're very careful with this part of it. Look at your specific parts and, you know, make sure you're doing it properly. If you're buying a new CPU, I'm pretty sure all the ones I listed will come with thermal compound pre-applied. That's going to be like it's a thermal paste that sits on top of your CPU and then makes contact with the heat sink on the back of your cooler. One second, I'm sorry. Okay. I actually haven't installed an Intel chip before, but it works in a similar way. There will be some sort of indicator or marking that tells you which direction to install it. I think it may be easier with Intel because it looks like it's a little bit more of a rectangle than a square. All right. And then so next is you've got your CPU down there on the board, and you're going to put the cooling fan right over top of it. So the AMD and the Intel ones work pretty much the same way. You're going to look for those little screws on the bottom. And again, there's a proper direction to align it. Screw that in. You want to make sure it's firm, but you don't want to, screw it all the way down into the board. So just, make sure it's on there good and tight, but you don't need to over tighten it. And then you'll have a wire running off of the cooler. Then just look for something like the right picture on your motherboard, and you'll plug it right into there. It should be labeled CPU fan, but anything that connects to it should work. It'll look something like that with the four pins. All right, and then the next, you'll put in your RAM sticks. So there is a proper way to do this. Most motherboards will have four slots for you to put your RAM into. And then if you see where that little red circle is, there it's labeled as 1, 2, 3, 4. So if you're only using one RAM stick, you want to put it in one. If you're using two RAM sticks, you want to put it in one and two. And then, of course, if you're using four, just put them all in. But that does make a difference with performance. They're going to run a little bit faster if you put them in the correct slots like that. All right, and if you chose to use an NVMe drive, it's those fast little SSDs that I talked about, you'll want to put this on the board before you put it into your computer. So you're going to have a little slot like what you see towards the right of that picture, and it's going to kind of stick out like that. And then you're going to have, you see kind of under it, you have those three silver things. Usually this is the size, but sometimes they can be smaller. So you just screw it down in whichever size fits your drive. If you're using a hard disk or a SATA SSD, it kind of makes more sense to install those after you already have everything in the case. All right, now you have everything on your board. You'll want to look for the mounting points. So kind of be arranged something like this, what's in the red. You'll just screw those down into your case. Again, make sure they're tight, but you don't want to over tighten anything in a build like this. And if you went with a board that has integrated Wi-Fi, like I said, you probably won't have to do what is pictured on the right, but that's your I/O shield. So if you have your, it should come in the box with your motherboard. You want to put that in the back of the computer first, and then install the motherboard to make sure that everything's protected from the outside. All right, and so that picture on the right is probably the most frustrating part of plugging things into your motherboard, because those connectors are tiny. Like, those LED switches are literally just one pin. So for this, I'm just going to say, look at your motherboard manual. It's usually in the bottom right hand side of the board, but they're all different. And those letters on the motherboard can be so tiny and really hard to read. So, look at the manual and make sure that you're plugging everything in. It should have similar labels to this, so you'll know where to put it. And then that picture on the left is another fan output. So if your case came with fans, or if you've already installed the fans, you'll need to plug them into the motherboard to ensure that they're powered on. All right, and so if you went with the GPU, what you're going to want to do is install it into, you should have yours, depending on the motherboard, they're going to look a little different, but the port will be the same. If you see those three silver ports kind of on the bottom are PCIe slots, you'll want to plug it into the very top one. It's going to offer the best performance, and then just screw it in kind of where this guy has the screwdriver. Your GPU will have some mounting points there as well. And then you want to make sure, look at this right picture here, that you plug in your display to the HDMI port powered by the dedicated GPU and not the one up top. So the one up top, if you don't have a GPU, that's going to be your integrated GPU, if you buy a CPU that has that feature. All right, and so it's pretty much all assembled now. You just need to plug the power supply into everything. On the left is what the port's going to look like. You may have more or less of those ports depending on which GPU you get, but the motherboard typically is just going to be those two. Another time, just look at the manual. You may have, like, if you're motherboard has like integrated audio or anything like that, there's going to be other things you need to plug in, but those are kind of the main things that your GPU needs to be, or I'm sorry, your power supply needs to be plugged into. All right, so it's pretty much all set up now. You just need to connect antenna if you're using, you know, Wi-Fi. So that'll either be to your integrated Wi-Fi with the board, or if you have a network card, monitor, mouse, typical stuff's pretty easy. And the way to actually get it up and running is you want to go on another computer, can be just like a laptop or whatever, get a USB drive that's at least 8 gigabytes. And if you just Google Windows installation media, it'll have either Windows 10 or Windows 11 should be the first result. And then I recommend having this be the only thing on that USB drive. Typically makes for a smoother experience. So just install that on the USB drive. And once it's in there, you can insert it into the computer you just built. And you'll go into, when you turn on your computer, it won't have any Windows. It won't have Windows on it, so you'll need to go into the BIOS. And they all look a little bit different, but if you just kind of click around them with either your mouse, or on some of them you can only use your keyboard, just look for boot options. And if you named your drive something, or you know, if you know that your USB drive is like F: or E: or whatever, then just identify that where you installed your installation media, and then just click on it. And it'll ask you where you want to install Windows. So if you did that thing I mentioned earlier, like, you know, you got a smaller SSD drive that you're going to use to boot, make sure you're choosing that and not like a hard drive or anything that you have as secondary storage. And another thing is, I mean, I've been using a non-activated copy of Windows for like almost 2 years now without paying for it. And the only thing is you can't change your background, and you have a little activate Windows watermark in the bottom. So another way to save money. And that's it for putting it together. Next couple slides, I have some PCs that I've built. And so this is one that my grandfather gave me, actually, that was like used for some CAD stuff like 20 years ago. And it was this really cool like aluminum case. So I took it out of his like attic. It was filthy. Kind of like took everything apart. In that right picture, I had to use, that's like the part of a door. I had to get creative with that to make the power button work, because none of that stuff worked from the old computers. But I took everything apart, cleaned it all up, got it working, put some modern stuff in it. And so that was a pretty fun little project. And then there is my current one that I use that I kind of had some fun with, and went with some like cool colors and some just aesthetic stuff that I wanted to put in there. So that's going to be everything from me.
Wow, that was so cool.
Thank you.
Now I know you're going to share that slide deck with us, right?
What's that?
Because that was a lot of really good information.
Thank you.
I took a bunch of screenshots.
Oh, yeah, I can share the presentation, sure.
Yeah, that would be really great.
Mm-hmm.
Great job.
Thank you.
All right, I think Isaac is up next.
Hello, everyone. Can you all hear me all right?
Sure can.
Perfect. Let me share the screen real quick. Let's see. All right. Can you all see my PowerPoint?
Yes, we can.
All right. Babe. So my name's Isaac. I've been working as a network administrator for U.S. Army for a little bit over 5 years now. And most of that time I spent literally configuring voice over IP phones using the Cisco Call Manager. And that's what I'm gonna be presenting with you today. So the Cisco Unified Communications Manager, or Call Manager for short, how I call it, it is an IP-based communication system that allows you to contact your coworkers or customers through audio and video, regardless of physical locations. Its primary functions, it's literally call processing and phone registration. So for those that are not aware, this is what a normal VoIP phone looks like. It's old. There are newer versions that are way more fancier, but most of them are similar in this setup, where on the left side, it's just going to be your front side of your phone with everything you need. And then on the back side, two key parts over here would be the label part over here. Oops, sorry. The label over here where you're going to find the MAC address for your phone, and then your ports over here. The port in the middle, that's the one you would connect from your phone to your switch. And that's actually what's going to power on your phone and actually be able to connect your phone and everything. The port to the right side of it, the far right one, is the best one if you have a really OCD when it comes to cable management, because that port actually allows you to connect your computer, workstation, or laptop to your phone and actually be able to access the network and everything through your phone. So instead of having two long wires of Cat5 running from the wall outlet to your cable, now you only need one long cable and then one short cable. So it's really handy when it comes to cable management. So to access your call manager, you literally only need to go into your favorite web browser and type in the IP address of the call manager. That's pretty much the only way you can access it. So once you type in that IP address and you click search, the first part's going to come up asking you for your username and password. Everyone's going to have different username and passwords. My company likes to use a default one, so don't use a default password, but do whatever you guys have to do. Once you log in, it's going to take you to this menu part here on the right side where you'll be able to see every single tab that you guys have on the actual Cisco call manager. And then this bottom part right here, it's like one of the, in my opinion, one of the best security features it has, because it tells you the last successful logon that someone has logged in to your Cisco call manager. So I had this one time that I didn't log in for one day at all. And when I logged in the next day, I literally saw someone other than me had logged in to my call manager that day before and ended up switching stuff around without my permission. So that was a fun day. But yes, just a key feature on that. So for the top right here, all these tabs over here have different settings depending on what you're trying to configure on your Cisco call manager. On the system tab here on the left, this is where you would actually configure your DHCP server in order for your call manager to actually send out an IP address to every and all devices that ever plugged into your network. Next to that, we got the call routing, which is only gonna matter if you're trying to place in route patterns, depending on what type of phone you're using or the phone you're trying to call to, you might have to add a specific route pattern for it. On the media resources tab, you're able to there configure what's called a music on hold file. So if y'all ever called a company and they're like, please hold, and then you hear that elevator music, yes, this is where you would actually go into and set up that elevator music. When I was in Iraq, I actually had made a lot of fun with this part because I changed the songs weekly. So one week I would have Careless Whispers play, and then the other week I would have Fireworks from Katy Perry play. And yes, it was definitely fun. Now, the tab we're going to be focusing on today is going to be this device tab over here. So once you hover your mouse over it, this little sub menu is going to pop up with everything that's in there. So we have the CTI route point, the gatekeeper, the gateway, your phone, your trunk, remote destination, and device settings. The one we're going to focus on and click on, it's going to be your phone tab right there. So after clicking that, it's going to take you to this menu where you're going to see every and all phones or devices that have plugged into your network. So, and it only takes one device to be plugged in, and it's automatically going to be popping up here, either registered or not registered. But even if you unplug them, it's still going to show that they were plugged in, and it's going to save that configuration from that phone and the information from that phone. So regardless if you plugged it in from one office and you took the phone with you to like a third office that's like on the third floor or something like that, and you plug it in over there, the Cisco call manager is going to remember that phone. And as soon as it plugs back into the network, it's going to re-register it without having to go through the process, which I'm about to show you today. So sometimes the call manager might have what's called an auto registration. That one most of the time works, other times it does not work. But auto registration is that instead of doing the whole process, which I'm about to show you, all you will have to do is plug in the phone, and the phone itself is going to come up and register with its software, its IP address, and then its specific phone number. So nine times out of 10, it works, but sometimes it doesn't. So, and then you would have to do what I'm about to show you right now, which is to manually add that specific phone in. So over here, you're going to click on the Add New tab over here. And then this is where all the magic starts happening. Your very first question that's going to pop up, it's going to be on the left side here. It's going to ask you for the phone type that you're trying to configure. When you click on the down arrow over here, it's going to show you every and all Cisco devices that the call manager can configure. So all you would have to do is scroll down and find the Cisco phone or device name that you're trying to configure and highlight it, and then click it, and then click next. After clicking next, this next tab's going to come up where it's going to tell you the product type. This over here where it says Cisco IP communicator, if you chose like a phone that's a 7960 model, it's going to say Cisco 7960. So that's going to change depending on the device you use. But the device protocol is going to stay the same, which is going to be the SCCP. The SIP, it's another configuration for a different device. So as long as you have the device that you're configuring is Cisco, then it's going to be an SCCP protocol. After you highlight that, you're going to click next. And I know it looks like a lot, but most of this information, it's literally going to be the default one, and you're not going to have to change. But the most important key features here is that every area that you see that there's an asterisk right next to it, it's literally the only things that needs to be configured in order for the phone to work. So, and most of that stuff is actually default. So on this left picture right here, you're going to see you have your product type. It's going to be the device you're configuring, the device protocol you selected, which is SCCP. And this first tab right here, which says device name, that normally is going to be either the what you're trying to name it, or it sometimes can be the MAC address of the phone you're connecting. So depending on the phone that you choose and the protocol, it's going to pop either one or the other. But that device name is where you're actually going to put in the name of that device that you're trying to configure. The device pool, which is the next one with the asterisk, that one, it depends network to network. So in my case, our device pool was a 7.11G pool, and that's literally the device pool that we had to select. But depending on y'all's organization, just choose the one that's local to y'all network. The next one over here is going to be the phone button template. So that template right there is just pretty much the software that the phone is going to use in order to give you that little menu on the screen. So depending on the phone that you choose or the device that you choose, you got to make sure that this button template matches that device. So if you hover over it and you choose a 7960 phone template, then you have to make sure that the phone you're plugging in is a 7960. Otherwise, it's not going to accept that configuration because it doesn't belong to the actual device you're connecting. Next one down here, it's going to be your location. This one, it's just going to stay at the hub none. Or depending if your organization says otherwise, then it's a default one that's just going to stay over here. Also, scrolling back a little bit on the user hold MOH audio source, this is where you actually place in the music on hold if you had that configured. So all you would have to do is click over here and then click the song that you have configured or anything, and it's going to add it to the phone. Scrolling over to the next side over here in the next photo, your next setting is going to be your common phone profile. This one, it's going to actually stay as a standard common phone profile, or it might change. It also depends, but we leave it as a default one. On location stays hub none. On the built-in bridge, stays as a default. The privacy stays as the default. The device mobility mode also stays as a default. On the owner one, here is a mix and match where you can either use one or the other. We use the anonymous version whenever we create our phones because our call manager, right now, the actual call manager out there, the most updated one, it's like version 17, I think it is, or 15, somewhere around there. My company is running version 9. So we're way outdated on that part, but it still works. So we use anonymous because if we use user, it starts using a little extra license that we don't have, and it just corrupts the whole setup on the phone. So we just leave it as anonymous and then skip to the next part. Then phone personalization and servicing provisioning also stays at default. So once you gather all that, your next one, you're going to scroll down and actually want to look for what's called the device security profile. This is pretty much the security profile that the phone's going to be using in order to connect with other phones. The important key feature there is that whatever security profile you use on that device, you want to make sure it is used on all of the devices that's connected to your network. Because if the security profiles don't match, they're not going to connect. Normally, whenever we use it, it's going to be like a non-secure SIP profile for MLPP. That's normally the one we use. But that might change depending on what network we're using or how we want to set up the actual phones. After that's done, everything else that comes after that is going to be default. So you can just scroll all the way to the bottom and click the little save button at the end. So once you do that, this menu is going to pop up. So everything that's here in the middle, it's actually everything you just configured the moment before. So it's going to tell you over here if the device is active, if the device is trusted, and everything. If the phone's plugged in, this right here is not going to come up. It's going to say, hey, it's inactive until you plug in the phone, and then this is going to reset and then give you the, hey, the phone's connected and everything's good to go. So since we know that the phone's good and everything on the software part is good, now we have to add a directory number. So you will go to the left part over here under the associations and click the add new DN button. So on the directory number, it can be as simple as a 6-digit number or even a 10-digit number. We use 6 digits in my area, but some other people like to use the 10-digit one just because it makes them easier. So depending on what it is, you can easily write here the number that specific phone's going to have. Now, make sure that if you're doing like multiple phones manually, make sure that directory number does not repeat on other phones. Because if you have two phones with the name with the exact same directory number, whenever I dial that phone, both phones are going to start ringing. And if I want to choose contact one person, but then someone in the other end answers it, and it's like, hello, who's this? And I'm like, hey, is this so-and-so? And they're like, no, wrong number. Then, yeah, it's going to be a bad day. So after you plugged in that phone, this you're going to scroll down to where it says line one on the device, and it's going to give you the device name. This top three tabs right here are, in my opinion, the most useful ones that you can have in order to make user experience better. So on the display caller ID, that's actually going to be whatever name you put in there. It's what's going to show up on your phone. So if you want to add a specific names for specific phones, that is where you would actually place in the name. And then on the ASCII display caller ID, that one is the name that's going to pop up whenever that phone's calling someone else. So someone that's receiving a call, instead of just seeing a random phone number, it's going to tell them exactly who's calling. If it's, oh, the director of this department or the manager of this department. So it comes really useful for the user experience and literally makes your life easier in whenever you want to answer the phone or want to know who's actually calling and for what. The line text label, that one, it's going to be the same thing. The same number or name you place in is going to pop up there. So after you do all of that, you're going to scroll all the way down and click the save button. It's going to go through its simple save configuration, loading and everything. Once it's done, you want to go ahead and click the apply configuration button. What this will do is that everything that you just saved on this directory number, it's going to go ahead and apply it to your phone so that it makes those changes on the actual physical phone. So don't be scared if the phone starts turning off and turning off, turning back on and turning off, because that's how it's going to do until it's going to come up fully up with the correct configurations and everything there. So it's scary, but believe me, the phone's perfectly fine. It's just like to do that. So after that, you're going to go ahead and go back to your device tab up here and then your phone subcategory. And you should be able to see the phone you just plugged in with the device name, the description that you set up with it, what pool they belong to, the protocol they have been assigned. And it should say registered. That's what it means is that it's been fully registered with the Cisco Call Manager. It has an IP number. It has an IP on it. It has a directory number on it and everything like that. And it's fully able to make phone calls and work perfectly fine. And then over here, it's going to tell the IP address that it's been assigned. So once that's done, you're going to see that your phone, it's going to go from looking like this left phone where it says configure NP and there's nothing on it to the picture that's on the right where it's going to show you the phone number you have added to it, the name of the phone, and then all your options are going to be here for the redial, new call, and everything like that. When a phone is like this, it's pretty much when you're 100% sure that you can actually make phone calls and it's going to work perfectly fine. Well, thank you for y'all's attention. That's pretty much all I have for my presentation, and I hope you guys have a good night.
Thank you, Isaac. That was really great. My company uses Cisco VoIP phone to connect, the agents connect to the client's phone. Inside of VPN, so I'm very familiar with Cisco phones.
That's awesome. Oh, yes, it's definitely, how to explain it? I'm used to it, too. The only issues I have is that our call manager, since it's always outdated, we have to use the old phones. So when you see the new phones, they're like so much prettier, so much nicer, so much easier to handle. But then right. Our phones, we have to run like the old version because they do not have the new software for those new phones.
Well, we're crossing our fingers for that you get the new stuff.
Oh yeah, we're not expecting to getting anything new to like pretty much July of this year. But the only good thing I like about the call manager is that compared to Call Manager Express, that everything else is on the command prompt. It's definitely more user friendly over here.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much. I think Pax is the last presenter. You are up, Pax.
Hello. Yes, I am the last one. I'm going to keep this short because, you know, I know everybody is trying to go probably get some sleep. So I'm going to start sharing my screen real fast. I don't want to update my driver right now. There we go. Sorry, got to change some permissions before I do this. Okay, let's see if it will work. Can you guys see my screen by any chance?
Not yet.
All right, let's try again. Okay, perfect. How about now?
Yep, sure can.
All right, perfect. So this will be a bit similar to what Michael was presenting. He was talking about GRC. This is kind of the other side. While he's in the industry, what I did and what I'm going to be doing is consulting as an outside firm, kind of providing insights to firms for cybersecurity and what they need to do to be compliant with you know, different laws and regulations. Most of the things I worked with and most of the companies that were my clients were either healthcare or government contractors. And those two categories of companies have to specifically follow a series of rules under NIST and HIPAA. I know Michael mentioned NIST RMF, which is the risk management framework. What I worked with was NIST CSF, which is the cybersecurity framework, and then HIPAA privacy rule and also security rule are very useful when you're a you know, a hospital or any kind of entity that is dealing with basically identifiable information or healthcare information that is stored on any type of technological devices. So the way it works, I kind of wanted to describe like a day as a consultant and how it works when you get a client. And the way it works is you set up interviews first. It really depends on the size of the company you're interviewing with and the number of departments that they have, but from my experience, mostly every company has a CIO, a CISO, or an IT manager that is aware of basically everything that is going on in the company as far as cybersecurity goes. That is usually the longest interview that we had to sit through, lasts 4 hours. We go through a very specific questionnaire. Depending on what the company does, they either go through a NIST gap assessment or a HIPAA gap assessment or a joint NIST and HIPAA gap assessment that are kind of mapped out. I'll show you guys what it looks like a little down the road. But we would talk to people from the company, database managers, HR, head of security, whoever that has any responsibility as far as security goes inside a company to like be compliant with these rules. After the interviews, depending on what information we've gotten from them, we usually send a request out for forms and, you know, policies and documentation, because we have to take notes inside the interview, and then we have to verify everything that has been said in the interview with their policies, because when the time comes for auditing And the government comes to audit these companies. They check both the policy and the documentation and what is actually going on in real life. And a company can have, I don't know, let's say they have a SIEM system set up and they have a log system set up, or it can say that they do in their policy and they actually don't. So you really have to get in there and make sure that everything matches up before any audits. And one point here is that audits are not fun when your company gets audited. It usually comes with not just suggestions or recommendations. It comes with fines and, you know, people getting laid off if everything is not okay. So usually consulting firms are hired before audits are done to give recommendations. We do the exact same thing that auditors do, except we don't find them. We just, you know, take the money and we give our recommendation to fix everything before any auditors come. But yeah, these are some of the documents that I've dealt with. Sometimes it's one huge document, 300-400 pages long with like a table of contents that includes everything. Those are usually the security policies. And sometimes they're very nice and, you know, short documents. They all have different labels saying, I don't know, data retention policy, acceptable use, onboarding, offboarding, all the HR things, business continuity, and disaster recovery plans. After we take those documents and do our interviews, we have to go ahead and write a report. And this report is based off of this NIST and cybersecurity, NIST cybersecurity framework and the HIPAA privacy and security rules, depending on what the company has asked us to do. So I'm going to go ahead and show you guys one tool that was very useful for me to use when I first started doing my work as, you know, a consultant. This was the first thing that my manager showed me when I started, and it's very, very useful, and it has everything anybody would need. So this is supposed to work, but I knew it's not going to work, so I am actually, I have this pulled up right here. Can you guys see this or no?
Yes.
I don't think. Oh, yeah. Perfect. So the CSF tools right here. Okay. So this CSF.tools is directly related to NIST, and they have all of the, you know, NIST documentation that you would need. Usually the NIST CSF is a combination between NIST SB 800-171 and 853. What most companies that deal with HIPAA use is the 853 revision 5, because it maps out very nicely to HIPAA. When you put them together, it's kind of like you're looking at the same things. The difference between the two is that NIST gets broken down into controls and HIPAA gets broken down into safeguards. And, you know, HIPAA is a little more general. They kind of give you a guideline, but they don't tell you exactly what to do, which is kind of annoying because when they audit you, they're very, very specific. So people use NIST to have a better understanding of what to actually do. This representation of NIST under the CSF tools is very nice. It has everything broken down. So NIST has these five components: identify, protect, detect, respond, and recover. When you hover over it, it tells you exactly what this is. And then it gets even better. You just click on it and it gives you all the controls under that. And then you can go even further down and further down, and it just keeps on going. But just to give an overview of, you know, these controls, the identify is usually where you kind of develop an understanding of the procedures inside of a company. It gets broken down to asset management, which is where you get into inventory. Like, how do you guys do your software and hardware inventory? Are you aware of everything that is on every computer and every device on your network? Is everything labeled? Is everything, you know, like confidentiality wise, is everything labeled? And then you have the business environment. You got to see like, what's your objectives as far as roles and responsibilities go? Does everybody know what they are doing inside the company or not? Because if they don't, that can be very risky. I'm not going to go through all of this, but you know, we have governance and risk assessment, which is usually why people show up for consulting. This is where they get and they're like, okay, well, we kind of need help. We need somebody to tell us what to do. And then we go in, we show them what to do, and then they get to protect. They try to secure all of their systems before anything bad happens. But with technology, it's kind of impossible to protect everything. You are going to have some type of vulnerability somewhere. As it was said before, there are certain things like software that a company needs to use, and they're aware that it's vulnerable. It's just kind of how you take that risk. Are you going to choose to ignore the risk because it's, you know, the likelihood is very low on that risk happening? That happens a lot. But then when the vulnerability gets exploited, then they have to detect it and they have to respond. And the recovery is where the disaster recovery plans and business continuity comes to place. But yeah, it's a pretty exhaustive process. It takes months usually. I worked with one client that it took over 3 months just to get interviews done, because every time we had an interview, they would give me an answer and then I'll go into their documentation and then I'll go into their systems and I would realize that, oh, well, you forgot to tell me that this one was broken. And then we have to set up another interview because everything has to be very official and everything has to be noted, because there's a confidentiality problem that you can't share these information with anybody other than the person that that gave it to you. So yeah, it does get a little exhausting, but the outcome is always good. And also, I personally really enjoy these things. I love working with policies and just reading through what people are doing wrong. Other than that, we do have HIPAA. So this is a very good source. It's literally their website. If you're curious about what the HIPAA privacy rule is or the security rule, it's very easy to just Google a summary of them and they'll tell you exactly what they are. They're concerned with how healthcare information is stored and transmitted within companies and outside of companies with their third parties. Because, you know, most hospitals, especially large hospitals, don't process their own patient data. They always outsource it to some third-party company that works with data, and that company needs to be evaluated as well to make sure that they don't have any security holes. And you got to make sure that all the personal, like the PII, is scrubbed before the information is transmitted. And this is an example of what the HIPAA controls look like, or their safeguards, versus NIST, which is laid out like this. This is what HIPAAs look like. It gets to like unique user identification. It has all of these weird numbers in it, and there are a lot of them. It can get to about, I think, 104 different safeguards, depending on which document you're looking at and what you actually need to be answering to as far as auditing goes. But yeah, this is another one. So the funny thing about this is that you are a cybersecurity consultant, but when you go in, everything is a part of cybersecurity. Like, you have to check the doors for, you know, do you have safe exits? Do you have safety for like fire hazards? Do you have safety for like water hazards? So everything kind of falls under cybersecurity, because at the end of the day, if your hospital catches on fire, you're going to have data in there and something bad is going to happen to it. I know this sounds very cynical because there are definitely people in there too, but as far as our job goes, we have to make sure that your IT hardware is safe and in a good position to kind of protect everything that patients have given you. But yeah, that's day in the life of a cybersecurity consultant. I just want to give this presentation because when I first started studying cybersecurity, I had no idea that consulting was actually a job. It took a few years for me and a very unexpected job offer from a company to realize, oh yeah, this is an option. So yeah, I hope this was helpful. If anybody has any questions, go on ahead. Other than that, thank you for listening.
Wow, that was awesome. Thank you for that. I work in the healthcare industry, so I am well aware of all those security protocols, and I'm the site lead at my call center. So we have a NIST room where the computers are built and for government contracts, and only certain people can go in there, and they have to be turned on specifically at different, you know, junctures throughout the month. There's just a lot of security protocols to all of that, and you gave me a lot of information there that makes sense now.
We are usually the annoying people that show up, and not really anybody's favorite person to show up to your job. I'm going to be the one to tell you, like, you have to do those little things, and most of the times it does get ignored. But the good thing about consulting work rather than, I don't know, hands-on in-house security roles is that you're not responsible. So if I say something and you don't do it, I don't have to pay for what you've lost. So yeah, that liability aspect is really good, especially for like starting a career in cybersecurity. It gives you good pointers as far as what you can learn, but not being liable for anything.
Well, great job. So does anyone have any questions for any of our presenters? It was a lot of really great information, everyone. No questions? All right. Well, I will go ahead and close the meeting down. I'll stop the recording, and of course, if you want to rewatch it, it will be available. I hope everyone has a great night and a great weekend, and we will see you next week. Have a good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks for all the information, guys.